From WVUR Boston and WRNI Providence, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. As the United States weighs its options for war on Baghdad, Israelis prepare for the worst. Anti-missile batteries are lined up across the country on watch for Iraqi Scud missiles like the ones launched against Israel in the Gulf War a decade ago. But today, Saddam Hussein may be exploring other ways of attack and teaming up with suicide bombers for delivery. This hour, On Point, Israel on the front line of a potential new war with Iraq. First, talk of war in Iraq drives oil prices up. The last four U.S. recessions have been preceded by a sharp spike in oil prices. Last week, the price of oil pushed up over $30 a barrel. War could push it higher, with implications for the U.S. economy. Earlier today, I spoke with John Hilsenrath. He's a reporter for The Wall Street Journal in New York City. I asked him how much attention analysts are paying to the price of oil and the U.S. economy with the prospect of war with Iraq on the horizon.
The funny thing is people don't seem to have been paying much attention at all in the last few months. It seems that with so many other things going on with these corporate scandals and the stock market falling, that we all took our eyes off the ball and we're waking up at the end of August and seeing oil prices back up around $30 a barrel. At that point, people start paying some attention to it. At least a lot of the economists that I do, it isn't lost on them that the last four recessions that we have had have all coincided with or been preceded by $30 a barrel oil.
So here we are headed into winter and potentially headed into war as well. Are people linking the recent price surge with apprehension about war in the Middle East, or is this oil rising on its own accord?
Well, there's a lot of things going on here, but certainly a number of people say that the oil market is attaching what they call a war premium onto prices, with the possibility that we could have a war and the uncertainty that that brings about the outlook for supplies. Oil prices have gone up by at least, a few dollars a barrel. It's hard to separate that out from other things, from supply concerns, relating to just regular demand and the amount of cheating that OPEC is doing. But there does seem to be a war premium. It's hard to put a number on it, but it's there.
What does the war scenario look like in the eyes of economists and others who follow potential oil prices? If the U.S. should attack Iraq, what are people anticipating as likely effect on oil prices?
Well, that's another one that's really hard to call, because in order to do that, you almost have to be able to project how a war is going to go. You kind of should be talking to a general for that. There are two basic scenarios. There's the optimistic scenario and the pessimistic scenario. In the optimistic scenario, the war ends quickly, and all of a sudden we have a lot of oil that's coming onto the market from a free Iraq, and we're dealing with gluts and fast-falling oil prices. The pessimistic scenario is that the war is drawn out, that the Middle East is outraged by the developments of the war, and OPEC potentially restrains supply, and you see oil prices going up to 30, 40, even more dollars a barrel. So, and this is why there's this premium being attached now, because it's a risk premium, and you get risk premiums when there's a great deal of uncertainty. We could have in the next year $10 a barrel oil or $40 a barrel oil, and nobody really knows which way it's going to go.
If there is a war, presumably supplies from Iraq itself would be disrupted for some time. How important a supplier of oil is Iraq these days? How consequential is Iraq's contribution to oil prices?
Well, of course, supplies from Iraq have been disrupted for more than a decade, and the UN has changed its pricing formula for Iraqi oil, and that has disrupted supply coming out of Iraq even before a potential war is upon us. So, Iraq has been a disrupted player for some time. I think the bigger concern is how it affects oil coming out from our more important trading partner, and that's Saudi Arabia.
Saudi Arabia has something like 8 million barrels a day of production at this point compared to Iraq's 1. Is that right?
This is the other interesting piece of this, and it's what makes it more unpredictable. Saudi Arabia is a very important supplier, of course, but we have new suppliers who are more than happy to pick up some of its production shortfalls.
Such as?
The obvious one is Russia. Because of this, OPEC is under some pressure to keep pumping the oil, because if they restrain supply, then you potentially have Russia coming in and picking up where Saudi Arabia and its OPEC partners leave off. So there are a lot of moving parts here. The important economic angle of this is that when oil prices rise, effectively what you have is a transfer of wealth from American households who need oil for gasoline to take their long trips in their SUVs, and as the winter approaches, for home heating oil. And the rule of thumb is that every dollar a barrel increase in oil amounts to about a $5 billion transfer of wealth from American households. So we get oil prices that go up over $30 a barrel and stay up there for several months, it could start pinching consumer spending in households. And that's important for a couple of reasons, one of which is last year at this time, the economy's resilience surprised a lot of people. And part of that was because gasoline and oil prices fell dramatically after September 11th. As we went into the Christmas shopping season, a lot of consumers found they had more disposable income and they used it. We're potentially going into a reverse image of what we were going into last year at this time, where gasoline prices and home heating oil prices could be rising going into the Christmas season.
And how consequential would that be for the U.S. economy? How dependent is the U.S. recovery on a steady, moderate oil prices?
The U.S. recovery isn't looking very healthy right now. Mm-hmm. We've had the stock market has taken some wind out of consumer spending. The job market is basically stagnating. So this is just another headwind, and it doesn't help. It would have to be sustained well above $30 a barrel for several months for it to really create a pinch for a lot of households. But when we're coming out of a recession staggering the way we are, you don't want to see more headwinds.
John Hilsenrath, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
John Hilsenrath is a reporter for The Wall Street Journal. He spoke with us from New York. Israel has kept a wary eye on Iraq for more than a decade, and with good reason. During the 1991 Gulf War, Saddam Hussein's forces launched 39 Scud missiles at Israel and held back another 25 Scuds reportedly fitted with germ warheads. Now experts say if the United States attacks Iraq, Saddam Hussein may not hold back his weapons against Israel. And this time around, Iraq's attack on the Jewish state may not come from the air, but from Israel's own streets. In a new article in the current issue of The New Republic, Jerusalem Post correspondent Janine Zakaria says that Hussein may be working to combine Iraqi weapons with militant Palestinian guerrilla skills to create a deadly scenario for Israel, the threat of hand-carried biological weapons dispatched by a dictator with nothing to lose. Would an American attack on Iraq inevitably draw Israel into the conflict this time? How do you think Israel would respond to a biological attack? Would it go nuclear? Should it? What are the risks and rewards for the Jewish state and the region if Israel is pulled into this war? You can join the conversation tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joining us tonight from Jerusalem is Janine Zakaria, Washington correspondent for the Jerusalem Post and author of the article Stealth Bomber, Why Saddam Doesn't Need Missiles, in the current issue of The New Republic. Good evening, and thank you so much for joining us, Janine Zakaria.
My pleasure, Tom.
It's good to have you. Also with us from the studios of Vermont Public Radio is On Point News analyst Jack Beatty. Good evening, and hello, Jack.
Hello, Tom.
Janine Zakaria, you've outlined a thesis that you say is keeping Israeli defense planners and analysts up at night. Describe to us the fear this time if the United States and Iraq go to war for Israel.
Well, I guess the first thing to point out, though, is that there really is no panic yet here in Israel on the streets. People aren't exactly rushing yet to refresh their gas masks as the Sharon government is starting to advise people. But where the real concern is, like you said, among the defense planners, people whose job it is to think up the potential scenarios for an attack by Saddam Hussein. And the main threats are, as we can't ignore the threat of a possible missile attack. As you pointed out in your introduction, Saddam Hussein launched 39 Scud missiles at Israel, conventional Scud at Israel in 91. Mm-hmm. But beyond that, beyond the threat of possibly this time a non-conventional warhead, there is this concern, a deep concern, I would say, that Saddam Hussein could team up with Palestinian militants, equip them with some sort of a germ or virus from his biological arsenal and give it to the Palestinians to use against Israel.
Janine Zakaria, you're raising a lot of issues at once there. Let's dig into that. You quote a U.S. intelligence source saying, if Washington goes ahead with a plan to remove Saddam, he will have every incentive to attack Israel with the goal of killing as many as possible. I guess there's a native logic to this, but walk us through why Saddam may be more aggressive toward Israel in this potential conflict than he was in the Gulf War.
Right. Well, the difference this time is if you take the Bush administration at its word, this time they're planning on going after Saddam himself. In 91, of course, the U.S. stopped short of Baghdad, and Saddam, whose primary goal always, any expert will tell you, is to hold on to power, knew that he would suffer dramatic consequences if he used non-conventional weapons against Israel.
That is more dramatic than being booted out of Kuwait.
Right, exactly. Exactly. This time, if the thinking is here, and there is a debate about it, but there is the general thinking here is that if the U.S. is intent on going after him and getting rid of him, then he would have nothing to lose by launching something non-conventional at Israel and would be willing to suffer a possible Israeli response.
What would be the potential gain for Saddam Hussein in resorting to using weapons of mass destruction against Israel in the context of a U.S. attack on Baghdad?
Well, the feeling is that maybe somehow, potentially, he could survive and be turned into a hero among many in the Arab world now, where hostility towards Israel is very high, and sort of just go down as a shaheed or a martyr on a greater scale than what we see today among, say, Palestinian suicide bombers. But it's something that both in the United States and Israel, this is a key question, sort of, how is Saddam going to respond when his back is up against the wall and he sees that he's about to be ousted?
Now, you write that Saddam Hussein has carefully cultivated his relationship with militant Palestinians. Give us some sense of that relationship today.
Right. Well, since for a very, very long time, he has allied himself with Palestinian groups, different factions of the Palestine Liberation Organization, the more hardline factions, the ones that have rejected Oslo, and who have since, say, Yasser Arafat's return to the Gaza Strip in 94, have sought sort of succor and support from Baghdad. Some of the more hardline factions that people might be aware of, for example, are the Palestine Liberation Front, which carried out the 1985 Achille Lauro hijacking, mm-hmm. the Abu Nidal Organization, one of the most infamous groups, and several others who are even currently now the vehicle for distributing, for example, some of the payments that Saddam Hussein is paying to families of suicide bombers.
This is the famous $25,000 that he tends to pay.
Correct.
Jack Beatty, here's another difficult facet of this potential war. Israel surely would like to be rid of Saddam Hussein, but if Janine Zakaria and the people she's been talking to are right, the risks of this conflict are particularly great for Israel itself.
Yes, and perhaps even great for the world. As I mentioned on this program a couple of weeks ago, in his Senate testimony, Anthony Cordesman, the strategic analyst with good connections in Israel, says that the Israelis have concluded that it was a mistake not to respond at the Gulf War and that weakened their deterrent. And that he thinks that what will happen, and he didn't quote people, but this was his surmise from talking to people, is that if the worst happens and Saddam does unloose weapons of mass destruction on Israel, that the Israelis would first declare their nuclear weapon. They have never done that. And then would detonate nuclear devices outside Iraqi cities. Now that essentially would put all that in the hands of Ariel Sharon. He objected to the 91 decision not to respond. And throughout his career, he has been imprudent to the point of recklessness. In the 50s, he led an attack in the 56 war that resulted in more Israeli deaths than any other in the conflict. He got his country into 20 years of war in Lebanon, had to be criticized by his own court for that. This man has shown himself for decades now to be a reckless leader in these situations, and this nuclear issue would be in his hands.
On the other hand, if the country's faced with weapons of mass destruction, any leader is going to respond strongly. What do you think? Is Israeli involvement in this potential new war in Iraq inevitable? You can join us at 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about Israel on the front line of a new potential war with Iraq. Our guest tonight is Janine Zakaria, Washington correspondent for the Jerusalem Post. You are welcome to join the conversation as well. What are the odds of Saddam Hussein taking a next war heavily to Israel? If Israel attacks Iraq alongside the U.S., what will the ripple be across the Middle East? Would Saddam unleash biological weapons on Israel? Would Israel use nuclear weapons on Iraq? You can join us tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Janine Zakaria, Jack Beatty raises the prospect of Israel in extreme duress pulling out its long-presumed nuclear weaponry. You've talked with a lot of analysts inside Israel. Can you imagine a situation unfolding out of a U.S. attack on Iraq that could lead to that?
What Israeli officials have been telling me is that in discussions that they're having at very senior levels, they're talking about something called a, quote, graduated response, which means something like, for example, if Saddam launches one non-conventional Scud, we will respond in such a way. If he launches a Scud tipped with smallpox, we're going to respond in a different way. Nobody is sort of outlining specifically what Israel will do. What's important to note here is that, for example, in 98, during Operation Desert Storm, Desert Fox, rather, when things were heating up again and the U.S. had some pinpoint strikes, former Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu at the time said that Israel, I think the phrase was something like, will know how to respond. He left it vague. In contrast, this time Ariel Sharon has made quite clear that Israel will respond because, as Jack Beatty pointed out, he felt that Israel's deterrence was damaged by its failure to respond in 91 under U.S. pressure. It's also important, if I could just add quickly, to note that while Sharon has a sort of a torrid past of sorts, he does have many critics right now within Israel on the right who are saying that he's being too moderate. People who have, for example, in his handling of the Palestinian situation, and that point to the fact that actually he will, in the end of the day, not necessarily be reckless if there is an Iraqi strike.
Janine Zakaria, could flesh out for us these concerns about a biological weapon attack. Israelis and Palestinians live in such close proximity that even if a Palestinian were willing to deliver this in some kind of suicide bomber style, how could that be done in such a way that it wouldn't also threaten large numbers of Palestinians?
Well, when I was talking to experts about this, the people who are actually thinking through the scenarios, thinking about what Saddam has in his arsenal, one of the main diseases that came up is smallpox. And as the listeners may know, Israel decided last week to vaccinate some 15,000 emergency workers with smallpox vaccination. Mm-hmm. And they're waiting to decide whether to vaccinate the entire Israeli population, something which is common in other areas but not here. The problem with smallpox for a possible militant who may want to distribute it is that it can be carried by the air into the Palestinian areas, which, as you say, are neighboring Israeli towns, and he very well may be reluctant to do that and cause his family great damage and even death. So what experts here will say is that he may opt for something else in his arsenal, a bacteria that could be used, for example, to do horrible destruction like poison the water system here, or use it in a building where the damage would be more limited and would not be contagious, say, like smallpox.
We're talking tonight with Janine Zakaria, Washington correspondent for the Jerusalem Post, about Israel on the front line of a potential new war with Iraq. Is Israeli involvement in this war on Iraq inevitable? You can join us at 1-800-423-8255. Julian is on the line. Hi, Julian. You're on the air.
Hi. I think you just covered my issue. I was an editor for a magazine last year called the Judeo-Medical Journal.
All right.
And we had commissioned an article by another Jerusalem Post reporter, Judy Siegel Itzkovich, about Israel's biodefense program. And you guys just discussed the issue basically that I was going to raise.
Which that being?
That if any kind of a biological attack on Israel could easily spread to the neighboring countries or to the Arab population.
But what about Janine Zakaria is raising the possibility of, for example, poisoning Israeli water supplies, which you're suggesting, Janine, I guess, are independent from Palestinian water supplies?
Yeah, I think these are real concerns. I wouldn't want to understate at all the threat to Israel. In fact, the woman who wrote the story for us wrote a sidebar in which she discussed the fact that she had actually given birth to her child wearing a gas mask during an Iraqi Scud missile attack. So.
But, Julian, would you agree that not everything in a potential biological arsenal would be something that would be contagious and potentially spread to surrounding countries?
Yeah, I would. I'd also say that there's a serious risk of a chemical attack. I mean, even if you distribute gas masks, you're by no means well protected. I think it seems to me, first and foremost, the risk of Scuds now being ably equipped with chemical warheads and the possibility of a massive Israeli response is I think it's really underreported in the American press and under-discussed. And
Janine, Julian, let me take your point to Janine, and especially on missiles versus this new notion, Janine
right.
Zakaria, of a kind of human delivery, suicide bomber-style delivery. You suggest that Israel feels fairly confident that its Arrow missiles could knock down incoming missiles from Iraq, but that it is much more difficult to deal with the potential hand delivery. How might that work?
Right. Well, first of all, there's no certainty here, obviously. A lot of this is all untested waters.
Mm-hmm.
But the difference this time compared to 91, there are a few key differences. One, Israel has in place the first operational anti-ballistic missile system, a limited one called the Arrow system, which has the capability to knock down Scuds in a way that Israel couldn't with the American Patriots in 91.
Mm-hmm.
So that's one thing. Israel has two batteries, which adds up to an unspecified, for security reasons, number of missiles, but some people say it's several dozen in each battery.
Mm-hmm.
They've scattered these missiles across the country, and they've got a sophisticated radar system so that when a Scud is launched, they will be able to knock the Scud, hopefully, out of the sky, even before the Scud crosses into Israeli territory, which leaves the problem of maybe a chemical or biologically tipped Scud landing, say, in Jordan or in the Palestinian areas. This
mm-hmm.
is something that's causing great concern in Amman right now.
So nothing is risk-free, but they feel relatively secure on the missile front.
Right, exactly. Now, if a missile does penetrate, however, the Arrow system, the feeling here among the security planners is that this would cause incredible fear, chaos, people would be frantic, but that Israel could isolate the area and treat the people, immediately do air tests or whatever it takes to figure out what was on the missile and treat the people in a localized way.
Though you also report, Janine, that sure. Israelis are being encouraged to upgrade their old gas masks and take home iodine pills in case an Iraqi missile should hit Israel's nuclear reactor and you've got a radiation leak.
Right, exactly. That's a new thing just a week or two ago. They're trying to think of every possible scenario here, and this definitely showed a sense of urgency that is starting to gather among planners that Israelis will take home the iodine pills in case of this very potential case.
But the human delivery scenario, what does that look like? Could one or a few people carrying biological weapons be effective in distributing them?
Yeah, I mean, you talk to some people here and they say, oh, this is ridiculous. Some of the skeptics who will say, this is, this is too hard to carry out. But then when we talk to other experts who say, well, really, we'll just take one terrorist, one Palestinian militant to take this stuff in, use an aerosol can to distribute some of these germs in, say, a school, or they paint these, flesh these particular scenarios out, go into a building in Tel Aviv, whatever, and you can cause some serious damage. And with many of these germs, what the experts will tell you, it will take a day or two for people to realize that they're sick, and they won't know who got sick, where it was distributed. It would be much harder to deal with in a reactive way.
Janine, can I ask you a question?
Yeah.
This is Jack Beatty. Your article, there's a kind of parallel fear you're drawing here. The administration says their main fear is not a direct attack by missile or anything like that from Saddam. His missiles only go a few hundred miles, but rather that Saddam will deal with terrorists. He will give terrorists weapons of mass destruction. They will bring them here, just as in your scenario, the weapons of mass destruction come in through the Palestinian militants. But that scenario applies, doesn't it? Even if the U.S. does not attack Iraq, that is to say, just as, you know, what the administration is saying, even if we don't attack Iraq, they may attack us. And isn't that true, too, in Israel?
That even if there is no U.S.
That even if the U.S. does not attack, that the Israelis are now afraid that there could be this link-up with the weapons of mass destruction through the Palestinian militants.
Yes, clearly there is this constant concern. I think that the concern is heightened, of course, when you give Saddam a real reason to attack Israel, or you give him a real a pretense or a cause, like you did in 91 when he used the U.S. attack, the U.S. efforts to oust Saddam from Kuwait as an excuse or reason to attack Israel, and that's where the concern is. It is a concern all the time, and for example, when Prime Minister Sharon comes to Washington, the two main issues that he raises are the existential threats, what he calls the existential threats of Iraq, and even more of Iran, and mm-hmm. that's something we can talk about too if you'd like.
Janine, you say along the lines of what Jack's inquiring about here that mm-hmm. Saddam's weapons and the Palestinian Authority's goals may be converging. What do you mean exactly by that?
Well, over the last couple of months, there have been some attempts by the Palestinians, the Palestinian militants, to carry out terrorist attacks on a more grander scale. The suicide bombings that we've seen regularly traditionally kill, say, between 10 and 20 or 25, and when you saw a bombing in a Passover Seder dinner in March killed 29 people at its peak. And there have been some attempts, for example, there was an attempt to, just in a very rudimentary way, by the Palestinians to say, put rat poison in soak the nails that they put in an explosive in rat poison to try and to kill more people through the poison.
But can you extend from that kind of measure, Janine Zakaria, to does logic or some other line of thought take us to the position of thinking, well, Palestinians would be interested in delivering large-scale biological destruction in Israel?
Well, I mean, no one knows for sure. This is clearly, this is like I try to point out. This is what they are making the link here, Israeli intelligence people, because they have to. It's sort of planned for the worst case scenario. Whether or not they're actually going to do it still remains to be seen. But there are declarations by Hamas, by Islamic Jihad, by the groups that are perpetrating these attacks, that they are trying to do something more destructive. And the Israeli cabinet is meeting regularly to discuss possible responses to what they're calling the, quote, mega bomb. And they don't know in what form or when or if this would come.
We're talking about Israel on the front line of a potential new war with Iraq. You can join us at 1-800-423-8255. Eric is on the line. Hi, Eric. You're on the air.
Hi, how are you?
Well, thanks.
I want to thank you very much for taking my call. My question is that there seems to be, from statements made by Hamas and Osama bin Laden, that they are very interested in creating chaos in general. They believe their opportunities come from the reactions made by others. And that is that I believe that although we're talking about the U.S. starting war against Iraq, that in fact, whether we start it or they create circumstances that create a war against Iraq, whether in Israel or otherwise, it works in their interest. And Israel has always been to Osama the little devil, with America the big devil.
So you're saying, Eric, that even it's not really dependent on war with Iraq, that the threat is there in any case.
Yes, and that in fact Hamas is only interested in killing Israelis of any type, whether they be children or non-combatants, because they believe they win if they kill more Israelis than Palestinians die in the Intifada, and that every reaction by Israel works in their favor, and if Israel doesn't react, it still works in their favor.
Let's put that to Janine Zakarian, and thank you for your call, Eric. Janine, this is the same point in effect, but how much do Israeli military analysts think that it ratchets up the possibility of a weapon of mass destruction being deployed if a war, a regime change war on Saddam, is the background?
Well, clearly, what the caller said is correct. That, I mean, Hamas has its own agenda regarding killing Jews, killing Israelis. Right now, always, this is their goal, regardless of whether or not the U.S. pursues its regime change goals in Iraq. But as I stated earlier, there is this concern that if the U.S. attacks Iraq, that there could be this link up between two enemies of Israel, Iraq, Saddam Hussein, and the Palestinians, and that this could cause the damage caused by a Palestinian terrorist to be ratcheted up a notch.
Michael's on the line. Welcome, Michael. You're on the air.
Can you hear me?
Yes, Michael. We've got you.
Okay. Well, listen, here's my thought and my question, I guess, which is I have this sort of awful feeling of a self-fulfilling prophecy sort of being enacted here. Mm-hmm. And I think what I mean by this is what we've always counted on to not have weapons of mass destruction used or transferred to terrorists by states like Iraq is deterrence, right? The mm-hmm. sense that if they do it, we're going to damage them badly.
They'll pay dearly.
Yes. Now, what happens when deterrence vanishes? That is, what happens when Saddam Hussein becomes convinced that, hey, he's got really nothing to lose? And isn't in that, in some senses, the most likely scenario under which the weapons will be either used or potentially even worse, transferred to terrorists? And so, you know, why are we taking ourselves, I guess is my question, into a realm where deterrence no longer operates and rationality becomes moot.
Michael, that's the heart of the matter, and I guess it's the heart of Janine Zakaria's article as well, that it is exactly that which is ratcheting up the pressure here. But Jack Beatty, to Michael's point and Janine's, there's a threat either way. You raise it by some degree, but then leaving Saddam there also means leaving a threat there.
Well, that was what I was trying to suggest earlier with Janine. I mean, are the Israelis, because I've read that the Israelis have given a green light to our war on Iraq, which in the light of what we've been hearing, Janine, is somewhat surprising, unless they think the chances are just there. And so long as Saddam is there, this link-up is possible, whether we attack or not, and therefore to get rid of Saddam is to get rid of those weapons of mass destruction. But I do think that, Eric, that Michael's point is so valid. This is what Brent Scowcroft said. This is what Larry Eagleburger said over the weekend, that our attack on Iraq is apt to make the thing we wish not to happen, either to our soldiers or to Israelis.
And yet, Janine, do you agree? Is there a green light from Israel to Washington on war on Saddam?
Well, first of all, it's not Israel's position as the junior ally here to give a green light to the United States.
But no doubt they'll be asked.
Yeah, there are definitely. Just today I had a meeting in Tel Aviv with a senior defense official, and we were talking about all this. And the United States and Israel are coordinating this time. There's no doubt about it. The U.S. has said, Israel has said, go do what you need to do, because it's in Israel's interest, not only because of the threat of a potential partnership between Palestinians and Saddam, but also this looming progress, that no one really knows for sure what's going on, but towards the nuclear program. Forget the chemical and biological weapons, which are horrific and terrifying, but there is this deep fear here of Iraq acquiring a nuclear weapon by, say, 2005.
Janine Zakaria, stand by. We've got to take a short break. You can join us, listeners, at 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about Israel on the front line of war with Iraq. Is Israeli involvement in this war on Iraq inevitable? What should the United States ask of Israel in a war on Iraq? Can Washington expect restraint this time? Should it? And how do we measure this tangle of risks and rewards. You can join us tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Our guest tonight from Jerusalem is Janine Zakaria, Washington correspondent for the Jerusalem Post and author of the article Stealth Bomber, Why Saddam Doesn't Need Missiles, in the current issue of the New Republic. Janine Zakaria, you were speaking just before the break about Israel's fear of the development of nuclear weapons in Iraq. And if that fear is serious, then I guess they're talking along the lines of Dick Cheney today when he says the risks of waiting are greater than the risks of going to war.
Yeah, absolutely. What I was trying to say was that on this issue of Saddam needing to go, Israel and the U.S. are of the same mind here for several reasons. Not only, as I point out in the article, of this alliance, say, of this similar interests between the Palestinians and Iraq and Saddam Hussein, but also this fear of Saddam acquiring a nuclear weapon in 2005. Recall, in 1981, Israel bombed the then nascent nuclear reactor at Osirik in Iraq, and was condemned worldwide for it, and later thanked by Dick Cheney himself, who pursued the Gulf War, for having carried that out. So I very much doubt that even if, say, the U.S. Does not go to war with Iraq, which there's no certainty still of that, although it looks like it, that Israel would allow a situation where Saddam is able to acquire a nuclear weapon.
Jack Beatty, whatever the threat, if Israel should jump into this conflict, should a war take place, and we have a lot of conditionals here, but they did restrain in 1991. The United States thought that was essential to holding together the coalition against Saddam. This time there's no overt coalition as yet, but if Israel comes in, that would be a huge rock in the pond of the Middle East perspective on any war against Iraq.
It sure would be, and if the worst, I mean, that's bad enough, but if the worst happened, and that is the Iraqis did use weapons of mass destruction against the Israelis, and the Israelis did respond with some sort of nuclear demonstration outside Iraqi cities, it seems to me the effects of that, well, imagine how Al Jazeera would play that. They wouldn't focus on the weapons of mass destruction in Israel. The world wouldn't. The world would focus only on the use of the nuclear weapon at whatever yield. And I think that would be a catastrophic era for Israel.
Janine Zakaria, how do analysts in Israel play out these dire scenarios? What would the impact in the region and globally be if Israel came in at a medium level of what you call a graduated response, and if it came in at a high level?
Well, clearly there is no overt support, as you say, in the region now for the strike. I was just in Cairo for a little short of a week. I got back yesterday talking to people about this, and they're not only against it, but they also resent very much being left out of the loop here in terms of Washington's considerations, saying, you know, this is our region. Why aren't they consulting with us? Why aren't they telling what's going on? But there is, you know, the United States does seem from over here to be ready to go it alone. And since you don't have that coalition, it sort of it frees up Israel a little bit in a way that it wasn't freed in 91. Albeit, if there was this this understanding, I think, in Washington from talking to people in 91, that should Saddam Hussein have used non-conventional weapons, that all bets were off in terms of Israel sitting on the sideline. I mean, this is a completely different kind of calculation on their part.
But Israel is known for, at whatever level, a tough response, fierce response when it's threatened. What's the calculation about what that does to the geopolitics of the Middle East if you have the United States and Israel side by side seen to be making war on Islamic Iraq?
Well, I mean, the feeling, I mean, I guess part of the feeling is that this is already the perception of the U.S. and in the Arab world, that the U.S. and Israel are on one team, and they don't like it, and they want the U.S. to be more what the Arabs, Arab leaders will tell you, to be more neutral. And Arab states say now, look, George Bush, President Bush, this is not the right time to be making war in Iraq, particularly when things are so tense and fire is flaring up in an Israeli-Palestinian conflict. They make that linkage. The U.S. has tried very hard to de-link those two, and I think has failed in a way that could jeopardize their ability to sort of solidify a coalition. Something that could make this effort much easier.
Listeners, does this Israeli factor illuminate for you just how complex, how dangerous this war might be, this region is? You can join us at 1-800-423-8255. Dave is on the line. Hi, Dave. You're on the air.
Hello. Do you mean this, Dave?
I mean you, Dave.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
You were talking about the question that whether or not Arabs would use weapons of mass destruction with so many other Arabs living nearby.
Mm-hmm.
First of all, as your guest pointed out, Palestinians have used chemical weapons in the past. In a sense, they laced their explosives with rat poison, so the victims bleed more. It's also a little known that on a small scale, they've used biological weapons already. There was a suicide bombing, I think, in July or June, where the bomber was actually stopped at a checkpoint, which is what the checkpoints are there for. So very few people were killed, but it turned out the bomber had hepatitis C.
Mm-hmm.
Now, that's not an airborne bug like smallpox is, but consider this. You've got a Palestinian culture where suicide bombers are glorified to the max, one might say. There are streets named after them. No less than 60% of Palestinians support suicide bombings against Israel, and many would just love the honor of what would surely be played as just a mass suicide bombing if smallpox were to spread from Israel to the West Bank, say.
Well, I wonder, though, and let us put that to Janine Zakaria, David. David is suggesting that the Palestinians en masse might find their own deaths from a biological attack on Israel somehow worthwhile. Does it really go that far?
Look, I just don't know. I mean, I really doubt it. I mean, the important thing to know about this conflict is that it's been completely hijacked by strong, deadly minority and who are willing to blow themselves up and kill as many people as possible. Now, whether or not en masse people are willing to die the death of a martyr in order just to kill more people, I don't know if it's on that kind of mass scale that the caller is suggesting. But there are these people that the point here is that you don't need that kind of mass readiness because all it takes is a few individuals, and that there are ways to do it. Say leave smallpox aside, where you can use germs that are not contagious. That incident with the hepatitis was back in June 2001, by the way.
And you say there's a debate in Israel over whether or not that was deliberate, having a
right.
suicide bomber come in who was infected with hepatitis.
Yes, yeah, so it's important to point out that there were some top Israeli medical experts who said this is common. There's no way to prove that this was actually the case, but. And I think there may have been a second case where either an alleged suicide bomber, a suicide bomber who succeeded and one who didn't succeed also had it. And there was another case where intelligence officials here said that they were planning a cyanide attack.
Giora is calling from Postville, Iowa. Hi, Giora. You're on the air.
Yes, I thank you for taking my call.
Mm-hmm.
I'd like to make a point. I think that the entire problem is taken out of context. We're not focusing on the real problem.
How do you see it, Giora?
Okay, I see it like this. Like the Intifada, let's say, for example, the Intifada begins with throwing stones, then it goes to using automatic weapons, then it goes using suicide bombing, and now suddenly we are afraid that they're going to contaminate the water supply. Saddam Hussein is going to throw nuclear bombs.
And what lesson do you take from that?
Okay, the thing is that if we don't stop, these people have to learn that it doesn't pay to attack America, it doesn't pay to attack innocent civilians, and whoever harvests or help or give money to that people will be punished. And if they know that, if they do that, they will be punished, they will think twice before they do anything like that. And this is what we have to do.
Giora, thank you for your call and your comment. Jack Beatty, there's a logic there, but at the same time, we've heard tonight about a sequence of events that could lead to nuclear weapons being used. I mean, all of this makes sense. All of it's very scary. One can understand all the planning for a response, and yet it seems wrong to be trapped in a cycle that leads to this higher and higher escalation.
It does. And, you know, if you say, what's the alternative? Well, what could be the alternative? I mean, Hamas really seems to want Israelis gone, or do they want they really want an end to the Jewish state. I'm not sure about some of the other groups. I'm not even sure about the Palestinian Authority. So if you say, well, the answer could be some forthcoming peace initiative that would, you know, defang this situation, it's hard to see where that comes from. Although I'm interested, Janine, what has been the response to the overture of the mayor of Haifa, who's talking about running for the Labor Party nomination on a platform that would basically say we're going to go the last mile with peace negotiations with whoever, or if that doesn't work, we're going to do unilateral withdrawal, including the settlements, most of them from the West Bank.
Janine Zakaria.
Has he gotten anywhere with that?
Well, he came out with a big splash about 2 weeks ago. You're referring to Amram Mitzna, mm-hmm. a Labor Party mayor of Haifa, former general, who is a new face. He's a fresh face, and Israelis tend to like fresh faces. And he's pointed out, as you said, that he would try negotiating. He's been vague about whether he would negotiate with Chairman Yasser Arafat. And then if negotiating didn't work, that there would be this unilateral separation and even a dismantlement of some settlements without in the West Bank without a peace deal. Now it's still too early to tell. The odds seem to be against. If you look at he did well in the polls, but talk to political analysts here, and they do not think he has a very good chance of winning the Labor Party primary this coming fall, simply because the country under terror bombings and the pace of the terror bombings has shifted to the right, has no faith that it has a negotiating partner, would be on the one hand willing to negotiate, but just doesn't see anybody to talk to right now.
Blood and fear are pushing things in another direction. Alexandra is calling from Greenville, Rhode Island. Hi, Alexandra. You're on the air.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I just wanted to bring the topic back around to what possible role Israel would have in an assault on Iraq. It seems your conversation follows a natural flow in that really for Israel, the only focus they should have right now is their own conflict with the Palestinians. They would be sorely stretching themselves out to even consider involving themselves in any type of conflict with Iraq.
But I guess the presumption here, Alexandra, is that Saddam Hussein may see a political and military advantage in attacking Israel and pulling it in, whether they want to be involved or not.
And with that prompting, we certainly would see probably a much larger coalition form among the other nations behind what we're seeking to do. Right now, we have no justification, as we did back in the Gulf War with the invasion of Kuwait, and we have no support.
Alexandra, thanks for your call. But Janine, Alexandra is assuming that an attack by Iraq on Israel might bring more allies behind the U.S., but it's not clear how that would break, is it?
Yeah, just before I answer that, the one thing he raises a good point in terms of Israel being very strapped right now in terms of it's pursuing its own war on terror domestically with the Palestinians.
Mm-hmm.
It's short on resources, and the last thing it has resources right at this current moment right now is to pursue a very expensive, resource-heavy war in Iraq. So in many ways, Israel, you could say, is happy to see the United States go in and do the dirty work here in a way. What they do want, though, is to be in the loop. That's their key concern right now. I mean, I can just tell you right now, this senior defense official I spoke to today told me, we don't know, and the Americans don't tell us what they are planning to do in Iraq. But what they have been assured of is, for example, early warning and things of that nature, coordination so that Israel will be able to respond, not participate in the offensive, which I think is an important distinction.
Janine Zakaria, it's been very illuminating to have you with us tonight. Thanks so much for staying up to this late hour in Jerusalem and for being with us.
My pleasure, Tom.
Janine Zakaria is Washington correspondent for the Jerusalem Post. Her article, Stealth Bomber, Why Saddam Doesn't Need Missiles, is in the current issue of the New Republic. And Jack Beatty, there we see the sort of crazy calculus of a conflict that's already just roaring along and could roar much higher once bombs start to fly.
Oh, yes. And today in the Jerusalem Post there's a poll. What do you think will happen in Iraq? And the answers, possible answers go from 1, covert attack is already underway. 2, there's a U.S. attack on 9/11. They're thinking that might happen. A U.S. attack following the election. A U.S. attack next year. Or Iraq attacks U.S. Israel. Those are the choices.
Yeah, well, take this cup away.
Oh, no, there's one other, saber rattling.
Yeah, well, we've got it all going on, I guess. Jack, thanks for being with us this hour.
Thank you.
Listeners, you can continue the conversation online at onpointradio.org. Click on forums. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
This is WBUR.